each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey, welcome, Winds of Change listeners. Father Tom Coyce here with you once again on a brain-wrinkling Wednesday. Indeed, indeed. I'm anxious to get into a series that we're going to do at the parish. I'm going to show you the light. I don't have that much money to give, like St. Paul and St. Peter when they found the crippled man begging at the Jerusalem gate. They said, "Silver nor gold have I none, but what I have, in the name of Jesus Christ, rise." So anyways, hopefully the silver and gold of the great treasure of our heritage, our Catholic heritage, will indeed be a blessing, be a great treasure in your life. And what I'm hoping to do is to introduce you to what I think is one of the most important encyclicals in the last 50 years, that is Pope John Paul II's Veritatis Splendor, the splendor of the truth. And so I'm going to try to introduce you to it, and I know I'll only be able to scratch the surface. And if you are anywhere near on the southwest side, and if you're able to come to St. James of the Sag, a little beautiful historic church in the woods, out there in the corner of Lamont, actually it's unincorporated Cook County, but we're going to have a morning session and an evening session starting Tuesday, January 28th, which is not right around the corner. Actually, we're what's even closer around the corner is our annual trip to Washington, D.C. We're going to be marching with the perhaps close to a million people trying to stand up and show that we believe that Roe versus Wade was a bad mistake in our nation's history, and that the right to life is fundamental, and without that fundamental right to life, then wow. So many other, yeah, that's the,
you just wrinkled my brain, man.
That's an incredibly brain wrinkling thing. I want to play a clip to you with you somewhere. I'll get it in. Jason Jones is the I did not realize his life story was so interesting. I've heard about him. He was the movie guy who put together Bella, if you remember Bella, and he also worked on another powerful movie called The Stoning of Sonreya, a very challenging movie to watch, but I challenge you to watch it. It's about how honor killing is still going on within radical Muslim communities. And let's see, I think he was involved in Unplanned, the story of Abby Johnson. Anyway, so he's made a number of movies, especially to try to promote life. And he was interviewed on the Taylor Marshall podcast recently, and you got to listen to it. It's very powerful. I'll share that with you a little bit later. But anyways, I want to break into an introduction to this great encyclical, Veritatis Splendor. It really it really wasn't meant for you, my regular, normal listeners. Pope John Paul II says right off the bat that he's writing to his fellow bishops. So it's a little bit challenging to weigh in on and to follow, but it's quite prophetic. And I think the warnings he issued and his attempt to hold on to, I'm going to call it a certain bond, a marriage, a covenant, a partnership.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
The encyclical Humanae Vitae is all about it. It's in there, though. This is kind of the theory behind why Pope John Paul II defends Pope Paul VI's encyclical Humanae Vitae so strongly. So we'll get to that. But I also have to share with you. Something stuck in my craw, as we sometimes say, right? There's something stuck in my craw. And what's stuck in my craw these days is the constant, now popular, new buzzword, which is disengaged. I'm hearing that word all the time. It's used in reference to people who don't go to church, primarily. It's used by church people to talk about non-church people. Well, that's what it is, I'm stumbling here. But I see there's a certain value to it, but there's something that I just don't like about it. There's something that I feel it's sort of to call people who are not going to church, who are not living the faith, as simply just disengaged from the church. I'm going to say it's kind of part of the problem, because it's kind of like a doctor misdiagnosing a disease. And the reason I say that is disengagement is not a very biblical term, and it's not really built on much of our history. It's kind of a mechanical term, right? It's a mechanical term, like two train cars are engaged, they're chugging along, but if you disengage one, we've all seen movies where the cowboy or the actors are running along on top of a train car and they disengage the caboose and the caboose falls behind, right? I guess that's somewhat, we could say that about people who don't go to church, but it's missing the idea of sin, I guess, is what it comes down to. There are certain things that are right and wrong, and there are certain obligations we have to God and man. And when we just think of people who don't go to church as disengaged, it's kind of like we're relativizing this faith that is so very precious to us. I just heard another presentation by one of the chief evangelists of the area. I'll just say that. And anyways, and he spoke about five areas that we can point to that describe why people are disengaged, why especially young people don't go to church. And they were interesting points, no doubt about it, in terms of not knowing or having an experience of a relationship with Jesus. Poor liturgy was also blamed. The young people who yearn for apostolic charitable activities to get involved in and the church not providing them, it was also blamed. Recognizing the Eucharist as the body, blood, the real presence of Jesus, presenter did not use the term body, blood, soul, and divinity of the Lord, which I think in one sense was a problem. And various other, but the point that was impressed on me is that all five of the reasons that he was pointing to why people are disengaged with the church, except for maybe that last one regarding apostolic work, that young people are burning for apostolic work, charitable organizations, you know, they're burning to build houses in Appalachia or in faraway countries, or burning to participate in soup kitchens. I don't think that young people are burning for that necessarily. They will like it, and they will love it if you get involved in it. There is such a that touches a charitable work. But my point is that the other aspects of the reasons that are assigned to the reasons why the nuns, the people who are disengaged, don't go to church, were all theological, or shall we say?
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, I hope so. And perhaps if some of the folks that are heavily engaged in evangelization efforts will plug into this Winds of Change radio show, not only myself here, Father Tom Coys, but I know Father Tony Bush, our great captain of this radio station. He and I think, quite often see things in very similar ways, and I'm quite appreciative. There are a number of priests and workers in the church that are sensitive to, I guess you could say, the ship being steered in the wrong direction. It's very difficult to do. But here, this is what I want to contribute most right here before I jump into Veritatis Splendor, and the reason why I think Veritatis Splendor is so crucial for us to dive into at this stage of the game. The reasons pointed to, and you hear Bishop Barron say this as well, who I love and hold very dear to my heart, but I think he makes the same mistake when he points out the reasons why young people, or the nuns, are disengaged, is the pointing to these theological or faith issues, even doctrinal questions like atheism and the way science has destroyed a kind of walk with faith attitude. That's I dedicated my show last week or the week before about that Occam's razor. That is very significant. But here I'm circling around what I want to say, and here's what I got to say: is that the major efforts of modern evangelization are pointing to the faults of faith and ignoring the faults of morality. And I think about this issue, it comes out very strongly in Pope John Paul II's Veritatis Splendor. John Paul II is constantly trying to hold these two together, the issues of faith and the issues of morality. Don't separate them. Hold them together. They come, they're intricately bonded. And the modern efforts to reach out to the disengaged are famously fearful of the moral issues, and that fear is destructive. I'll say it that way. As a matter of fact, as I was thinking about this theme, I couldn't help but think of one of my favorite gospel. Well, I love all four gospels, but I would say the Gospel of John is one of my favorites. I'll put John and Matthew as my two favorites, and then Luke and then Mark. Okay, but that's really neither here nor there. If you love them all, they're great. Obviously, they're the Word of God, the living word of God, and each has a special contribution. But if you know the symbols that go along with the evangelist, you know that St. John the Evangelist, his symbol is the eagle, And you can't, what I sense, I was just at a conference where a major evangelist was telling us, especially about the virtues and the methodology of the Alpha program, which is a outreach program, and the image of an eagle trying to fly with one wing came to my mind. These two aspects of a vibrant faith life, namely your assent to certain doctrines, your appreciation and participation in ritual life, obviously the sacraments, and that's the one wing. And then the other wing is the moral life, trying to be good, avoid doing wrong, and living according to a moral code. And I think it's got to be rooted in the fact that so many of us are aware of previous moral failures, that we just have a hard time addressing that in our evangelization outreach. That someone said, we were talking about the Alpha program at one of our meetings, and some people have heard about it, and it's implied, and there's a lot of people singing the praises of it in many ways. And I'll even go so far, there's got to be something good about it. There's something good in everything, in a certain sense, unless you're talking about pure evil, right? But there's something bad in it could be summarized in one little sentence, and that is the Alpha program, like many of the other evangelization programs of the past 50 years, fail when they incorporate, when they use, when they teach, when they have as a fundamental principle the following: there are no right or wrong answers. That's it. When you say, let's get together and talk about religion.
You just wrinkle my brain, man.
Yeah, that's the brain wrinkler. And that's the essence of why it will hurt more than help if that issue is not addressed somewhere along the line. And it shouldn't ever be introduced. That principle should never be introduced. Namely, there are no right or wrong answers. If that principle is introduced, it has to be corrected. It has to be weeded out. And I don't think that's much of a priority in many people. So anyways, hey, well, we're going to get into Veritatis Splendor after this break. And we will be right back. I'm Father Tom Kois. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stan's School is enrolling now for the 2020-21 school year. St. Stan's School is a PK3 to 8th grade Catholic school in Westtown, committed to challenging students achieve academic and social excellence, led by action and example. Explore all that St. Stan's has to offer at ststanschicago.org or call 773-278-4560 or visit St. Stan's School at 1255 North Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway, just one block north of Division on Noble.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
Sometimes in life, we are confronted with the tyranny of choice. I know. Stop or go. Hot or cold. Up or down. This way or that way. You can contribute to Winds of Change one way or the other. One way is to go to windsofchangeshow.com. WindsOfChange.com. Then click on Support Winds of Change Show in the upper right-hand corner of the page. The other is to go to ststandschurch.org and click on the radio tab to make your donation, one way or the other.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Father Tom Coyce here with you, trying to wrinkle your brain with a very important encyclical. I'm going to read some of it and try to give commentary on it, and I'll repeat an invitation to those who live on the southwest side of the Chicago area, out there in Lamont area. We're having an adult education series. It's going to start Tuesday, January 28th. We're going to have a morning session at 9 a.m. and an evening session at 7 p.m. So come on and listen. We're going to watch a little video, theologian talk about it, and then we'll discuss it. So come if you can. Here's how the encyclical starts by John Paul II. He says, called, I'll probably just get through the introduction here today. There's so much that we can see. We have to appreciate why he was moved to write this in the first place. And so he goes, called to salvation through faith in Jesus Christ, the true light that enlightens everyone. It's from Gospel of John chapter 1. People become light in the Lord and children of the light and are made holy by obedience to the truth. Obedience to the truth. Of course, obedience is not a popular word today, but that's obviously in the scriptures. It's obviously, we all know how at times if we don't have it, if we lose the virtue of obedience, we inevitably resort to knowing that we are the marker or the standard of truth, which is a real fast way to relativism, right? So anyways, he continues, this obedience is not always easy. Duh. As a result of that mysterious original sin committed at the prompting of Satan, the one who is a liar and the father of lies, man is constantly tempted to turn his gaze away from the living and true God in order to direct it toward idols. Isn't that now what I think is key there is the adjective about original sin. Notice he says it's the mysterious original sin. And I ask you, as I ask so many people, especially when I'm talking with people when they're preparing for a baptism, that is, a great deal of verbiage and a great deal of effort is made to help someone understand who's baptizing a baby, to understand how they belong to a community, how they are supposed to be a registered parishioner, obviously, these kinds of things, the belonging side. And that is a very real part of baptism. But what is very weak in much of our baptismal prep evangelization efforts is the understanding of original sin. And it's probably partly because people think they understand it. You don't have to spend a lot of time talking about original sin because what is there to know? That's what Adam and Eve did when they were in the Garden of Eden. They disobeyed God by eating the apple, and they were kicked out of paradise, and there we are. So why is that such a mystery? And I really think we need to appreciate the deep mystery. Saint Augustine wrote thousands of words on trying to appreciate what original sin means to us. And so a great saint like that still considered it a mystery and still didn't think he fully understood it. And I'm sure Pope John Paul II would say the same, even though he speaks about it so eloquently and voluminously so much. But he would still say, we don't completely understand. What don't we completely understand about it? What we don't completely understand about it is how the good God, who loves his creatures, would maintain or sustain a punishment upon the whole of human race for something just the parents of the human race did. I like to tell people, unless we can figure out why God allows death to continue and all the other punishments of original sin, we are going to have a hard time loving a God who does that because it seems so unjust, unfair. I like to use the analogy of the word perplexiate. Sometimes when I'm trying to explain original sin and the temptation of Satan to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and this all relates to the moral walk that John Paul II is trying to encourage us to be faithful to. When we hear Satan saying to Adam and Eve, God did not say that you will die if you eat of the fruit. He knows that when you eat of the fruit, you will know good and evil like he does. And you will become like God because you will know good and evil. And so if you appreciate, here's a way to appreciate that little dialogue between Satan and Adam and Eve. When Satan says, die, even the phrase, to know evil, because remember, it was the tree of good and evil. Translate the word die to perplexiate.
No!
For us, we know that if someone said to us, don't touch that or else you will die, that's we will have that same reaction that Homer. I think that's Homer, right? Yes, very good. We got Homer screaming there. If someone were to say, don't walk across the street or do not eat that apple, lest you will die, we know exactly what that means, right? Because we know we've experienced people dying and we know people get killed and we know people die from many causes and all the rest. We know exactly what that phrase means. But put yourself in the Garden of Eden and you're Adam and Eve and you're the first of all God's creatures made in his own image and likeness. And someone says, don't eat that or you will die. They've never experienced death. Death is nothing. They don't know what that means. It's like if I were to say to you, don't eat that apple or you will perplexiate. I've used this example a number of times with different groups, and I say, does anybody know what perplexiate means? And it's sometimes fun to hear, especially kids will guess, you know, more than adults will. And no matter what they guess, I can always say, no, that's not exactly what perplexiate means. And they keep going on and on. They think I've stumped them with a vocabulary word that they just haven't discovered yet. But then I reveal the truth. I say, I just made that word up. There is no meaning to perplexiate. I needed to share with you a word that I knew you didn't understand in order to teach the mystery of original sin. Because when God says to Adam and Eve, don't eat the apple lest you will die, they didn't know what die means. And it was hidden in the phrase to know evil. This is an evil when a creature made by God disappears or is eliminated, that's part of evil. And so when Adam and Eve were arguing with themselves, you could sort of paraphrase the argument that if Adam and Eve were hungry and they saw a delicious apple, in the physical desire, the hunger, the physical hunger, or the desire for pleasures of all sorts, which obviously the story of original sin beckons us to think about. And if somebody said, I don't want you to know evil, I don't want you to know what perplexiate means. And then Adam and Eve say, oh yeah, we want to know. We want to know what perplexiate means. And God says, no, believe me, you don't want to know what perplexiate means. And Adam and Eve both say, yeah, we do. We do. You see what I'm saying? God is saying, you'll die. And Adam and Eve say, what does that mean? We want to know what die means. And God wants to say, no, you don't. Trust me. You don't want to know what die means. Death is, I didn't invent it. It's not a part of the Garden of Eden. And it's a possibility. It's a real possibility. And believe me, you don't want to know what it is. It's part of something we call evil. And Adam and Eve tricked themselves with the temptation of the devil. The devil says, no, you do want to. Come on. You want to know what perplexiate means. You want to know what death means. And so here, by eating it, you say, yes, we do want to know. And so God is like, there's only one way you're going to know what death means. And that's if I let death enter into the garden.
Wow.
If I allow you.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, that's the foundation that Pope John Paul II is using as he wants us to dive into straightening out our moral problems of today. and so I see he's warning the bishops, and we need to reappreciate
this
warning.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
Yeah.
Danger.
He is warning. So let me finish with this, and we'll go to a break, because he says this. No darkness of error or of sin can totally take away from man the light of God, the Creator. In the depths of his heart, there always remains a yearning for absolute truth and a thirst to attain full knowledge of it. This is eloquently proved by man's tireless search for knowledge in all the fields. It is proved even more by his search for the meaning of life. The greatest reminds you of Viktor Frankl's great book, Man's Search for Meaning, right? A book that Dennis Prager says is one of the most fundamental, most important books that he ever read that helps him. If you know who Dennis Prager is, if you're a good radio listener, you should know. The development of science and technology, this splendid testimony of the human capacity of understanding and for perseverance, does not free humanity from the obligation to ask the ultimate religious questions. Rather, it spurs us to face the most painful and decisive of struggles, those of the heart and of the moral conscience. And that is, that's why he's writing this. The moral conscience is flat, or it's broken, as so many people are able to point out and see, as people say, what's going wrong? And why is there so much chaos? And the Pope is pointing to this, to the roots of the broken compass. And that's what we're going to get into more as we read more of the encyclical Veritatis Splendor. So let's take another quick break, and we'll be right back. I'm Father Tom Coyes. You are listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stan's School has an amazing PK3 through 8th grade program focused on leadership and social-emotional learning, and is one of the only schools to implement the Reading and Writing Project of Columbia University and the University of Chicago. Everyday math across the board, PK3 through 8th, is taught. by our highly educated and dedicated teachers. St. Stan's students are academically challenged with advanced level placement opportunities as their test scores and high school admissions speak volumes. St. Stan's is an integral part of the Wicker Park community, where you feel welcome and at home with other families and friends who enjoy the same warm, friendly, and safe atmosphere for their children. We have small classroom size, which makes a difference in the whole learning experience. Many schools have excellent programs. At St. Stan's, we empower students to be excellent. Join the St. Stan's family. It is a selective admissions process. Grades 1 through 8 are tested and interviewed. Call 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560. Or stop by at 1255 North Noble Street. That's one block north of Division, just off the Kennedy. More information at ststanschicago.org. That's ststanschicago.org.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
Every person in the world is actually Catholic. I am Father Thomas J. Loya with a Theology of the Body moment for the Tabor Life Institute. Catholic is really about the invisible made visible through the physical. Nowhere is this more true than in our human bodies. Pope John Paul II said that the body and it alone makes visible what is invisible. But so can bread or wine make visible what is invisible. So can water, oil, a candle, an icon, or incense. Furthermore, so does a birthday cake, a flag, or a Christmas tree. Physical things enable us to touch invisible realities. Catholics do not have to convert anyone. All we have to do is remind everyone that they have been Catholic all along, simply by the fact that everyone has a physical body. And the theology of that body makes an invisible God visible. To find out more about the theology of the body, visit taborlife.org. Taborlife.org.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. God bless Father Loya for all that he does to help promote the theology of the body. And as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, I think one of the very important issues we have to keep in mind is the battle going on in Rome over the Pope John Paul II Institute. There was a sad firing and a new hiring of a director of the Pope John Paul II Institute. And the simplest way to put it is the new director of the Pope John Paul II Institute doesn't understand John Paul II's theology of the body, especially in terms of what is known as absolute moral truths, that there are moral absolutes. He quite readily will dismiss that kind of language and that kind of talk about acts in themselves have moral goodness or evil as part of it, not just motivation and circumstances, acts itself. So speaking of which, before getting back to Veritatis Splendor, since this is, I'm recording this on the day before we leave for Washington, D.C. to go march in Washington for the Right to Life, I have to play a little segment of Jason Jones. Jason Jones I'll call him a prominent Catholic filmmaker now, although he wasn't. I didn't realize he had such a radical conversion in his life, and he was interviewed by Dr. Taylor Marshall. Some of you may know him. If not, try to Google him and listen to many of his interesting interviews and what have you. So anyways, Jason Jones is talking about how sad it was when Michelle Williams won the Golden Globe Award. Do you remember that from just a couple weeks ago? And he was saying a sad part about it. What she said was she's grateful that she lives in a time when a woman is able to have an abortion because she wouldn't have received this award if she had to have her child. And here's what. Let's see. Let's just go. Let's see if we can get from where they says. This is a
child. You remember that? Who was?
You know, it was heartbreaking. And then
that's Jason Jones.
What was the most heartbreaking about all of that was
talking about watching the Golden Globes.
The other women, how they reacted to that, how they cried. You know, they broke down crying. And you realize that all those women who were responding that way, I have to imagine, were post-abortive themselves.
Yep.
And Vicky Thorne, the founder of Project Rachel, she once said something to me that really broke my heart. She said, Jason, when men are involved in an abortion, they explode. Like, all this rage and anger comes out of them. My first year in the Army, I had 3 Article 15s for fighting. My first year. You're supposed to get kicked out after one in a career. I had 3 my first year and didn't get kicked out, thanks to my chain of command. But when I thought of all this energy that's been flying out of me now, you know, when Vicky told me this, it had maybe been 15 years in the movement, to think, she said, women implode. Men explode, women implode. She said, think of all your activity, all your activism, everything going out of you coming in. Mm. And that's really devastating. And so when that actress made that statement, and I saw the other actresses just sort of had this breakdown. And that's one thing that we're hoping to accomplish in our film.
Yeah, there he goes. And he makes a great point. Men explode and women implode. And you could say with the devastating experience of that abortion, in both need a super kind of healing, a super kind of new life. And God can provide that through mercy. You accept God's mercy. And I like to tell people, you know, God allows us to wander and stray. And he's hoping that when we come back, we're smarter and more on his side than we were before. That's so often true. I gotta believe that. So, anyways, that's a good little episode. You could listen to his whole interview with Dr. Taylor Marshall on his podcast. So anyways, I want to go back to this introduction to Veritatis Splendor. Why is the Pope writing this? He sees the. I'll say it this way. He sees that the Protestant Reformation, one of the key planks of Protestantism, has crept into Catholicism in a major way. And the way it has is following the teaching that works don't matter. Remember Martin Luther, one of his primary discoveries and, shall we say, contributions to Christianity was his teaching that it is faith and faith alone that saves us. And he did that. He's kind of he planted the seed that the William Occam's razor kind of came. I don't know if it's the parent idea. Is William Occam's idea the parent idea, and then comes the Martin Luther, or is it the other way around? Martin Luther chronologically comes before William Occam, but they're sister problem, they're sister errors, they're sister vices, because again, it's like chopping off one wing of the eagle. If you say faith is everything and works don't matter, you're going to try to fly to God with just your beliefs, and that has caused a tremendous rift in our moral conscience. Let me go a little farther here, where John Paul II says, the church's pastors, in communion with the successor of Peter, are close to the faithful in their effort to give guidance, moral guidance. They guide and accompany them by their authoritative teaching, finding ever new ways of speaking with love and mercy, not only to believers, but to all people of goodwill. The Second Vatican Council remains an extraordinary witness of this attitude on the part of the Church, which, as an expert in humanity, places herself at the service of every individual and of the whole world. And that's a better way to evaluate or take on Vatican II than what often is the case. What I mean by that is John Paul II is saying that Vatican II gave us a different attitude, but it didn't give us any new teaching and it didn't destroy any new teachings. How many times have people said, well, we don't believe in purgatory anymore, or you don't have to, or everyone goes to heaven, shall we say, or there's no such thing as hell, or the command, you can take a lot of what watering down the faith means, and they'll attribute that new teaching to Vatican II. And Pope John Paul II was adamant about saying it's just a new attitude about the idea of hell or the reality of hell, a new attitude about talking about purgatory, a new attitude. And you might say a more simple way, a more compassionate way, I guess you could say. But however it is, it didn't change any doctrines and teachings, which many people think it did. So he goes on, the Church knows that the issue of morality is one which deeply touches every person. It involves all people, even those who do not know Christ and his gospel or God himself. She knows that it is precisely on the path of the moral life that the way of salvation is open to all. I got to stop there, and I got to ask, is that an accurate description of what we sense today? I'm going to say it's not. Where it says, the Church knows that it's precisely on the path of the moral life that opens the way to salvation. There's a strong fear of the moral questions of the day. Keep those away. Don't, as much as I love and cherish, and I do miss Cardinal George, who was here in Chicago for many years, he had a phrase that I don't know if he initiated it or but he used it a lot, and a lot of priests and evangelists use it, where they say, don't lead with morality. And I want to say, don't always lead with morality, but sometimes you have to lead with morality. In other words, don't make it a absolute principle not to lead with morality. Because if you don't, you run the risk of letting someone dismiss morality and letting them keep their faith in Jesus alone approach to salvation. And that's the Protestant approach. Let me segue to my sermon from last Sunday. If you remember, we heard the theme about John the Baptist pointing to Jesus, and John the Baptist says, look, he is the one, he is the Lamb we've been waiting for. And I couldn't help but share a kind of personal experience with this. This leads to what I think the essence of John Paul II's Veritatis Splendor is all about. When John the Baptist points to Jesus and says, hey, he's the one, of course it reminds me of the Matrix and the discovery that Neo is the one. But it also reminds me of the experience, and I hope I didn't. I often tell people, I hope I don't scandalize you when I use little examples from my earlier days as a youth, when I was pursuing some girlfriends, let's say it that way. But I shared the experience that I think a lot of people go through. And for us guys, maybe guys will understand this more than girls, but well, it goes both ways. What that he's the one reminded me of is when you're searching, when you're starting to fall in love with a girl, you start to feel that she's the one, right? Or he's the one. Oh, no, wait a minute. There. Wait a minute. There's Neil. I thought he was sleeping.
He is the one.
That's Morpheus. He is the one. What's he doing? He's beginning to believe. See, he's awakening. And then he's able to fight the bad guy because now he truly believes who he is. Of course, he's a Jesus figure, of course, because he's killed and comes back to life. But Jesus didn't have to discover he was God, as it were. Anyways, that's a digression. But we're now in the analogy of the boyfriend-girlfriend. And one of the things I remember about my puppy loves, I guess you could call them, or desires to find the one girl, was, you know, when you're beginning to think that she's the one, many times I would see her car and I would get excited. If you're at a store or the library or the church or something, and you were wondering if the girl you're seeking and that you're falling in love with, if you see her car or some evidence that she's there, maybe a bicycle, if it's when you're little before you have a car. But I remember that feeling of just seeing her car would excite me and think, yes, she's here. I might be able to talk to her. I might be able to see her, that kind of thing. And or even another example comes to mind is the being in a crowd. If you're in a group or a party and you smell her perfume, you go, she's either here or she's been here, right? You know what I'm saying, guys? If that initial sighting, she's the one, she's near, she's here. I think young people probably know exactly what I'm talking about. And so, but then I actually got a chuckle out of the congregation when I said, okay, most of older couples, do you remember that? Well, I think a lot of them do remember that from their youth. But then I ask them, if you've been married for 25, 35 years, does seeing her car in the driveway get you excited? And that's where a couple of ladies just sort of bursted out laughing, obviously, because no, you're used to each other for that long. And just seeing that they're there, seeing her car is there doesn't do what it used to do because you're not in that seeking stage for the one. You found the one, you've attached yourself to the one, and now you are two and all the rest. But the fact that being together after 25 years and, you know, the mere seeing of her car doesn't excite you anymore, it's a natural occurrence. And part of the reason why is because after you found a human one, you realize that the human one is not the eternal one, is not the divine one that you're yearning for and seeking. In other words, yes, you have a human need for a companion. You have a human need for romance in the natural sense. But then after you have that and you sort of sense, you have a fulfillment of that, unless you start thinking of wanting to be a polygamist, you become, in a certain sense, satisfied in the sense that, well, you check that off your searching box, your things you got to do, find a permanent human companion. But then you realize once you have that, you're still searching. You still need more. And that's the window to the divine. And John Paul II says you won't be able to understand Catholic moral do's and don'ts unless you understand this need for marriage with the divine or bonding with the divine. Bond because the divine is the ultimate infinite good. This paragraph is so vital. I think maybe we could try to close with this, but this is the heart of his introduction where he says, today, and this is, of course, 25 years ago, and it's even more today. Today, however, it seems necessary to reflect on the whole of the Church's moral teaching with the precise goal of recalling certain fundamental truths of Catholic doctrine, which in the present circumstances risk being distorted or denied. Well, 25 years ago, he was predicting that they would be distorted or denied, and many of them are exactly that. Many of our moral teachings are distorted and denied, and we're not reflecting sufficiently. So here we go. He goes on. He says, in fact, a new situation has come about within the Christian community itself, which has experienced the spread of numerous doubts and objections of a human and psychological, social and cultural, religious and even properly theological nature with regard to the Church's moral teachings. It is no longer a matter of limited and occasional dissent, but of an overall and systematic calling into question of traditional moral doctrine. That, my friends, is a mouthful from the Pope. He's saying it's a systematic dissent.
Wow.
And
just wrinkled my brain, man.
I was talking to a priest not long ago and saying, you know, one of the difficulties we have to address as pastors and priests is the issue of dissent that permeates many of our schools and our lay teachers and lay ministers. And instead of saying, yeah, that's a darn good priority, his response was, what do you mean by dissent? Which is indicative of what Pope John Paul II was pointing to here. So he goes on, he says, at the root of these presuppositions is the more or less obvious influence of currents of thought which end by detaching human freedom from its essential and constitutive relationship to truth. That's so important, I got to read again. The detachment of human freedom from its essential and constitutive relationship to the truth. And in that regard, I'm going to have to blame the typical Protestant American spirit of liberty and liberty alone. We fight for liberty and we always just sort of leave it at that. John Paul II goes on, he says, is it possible to obey God and thus love God and neighbor without respecting these commandments in all circumstances? Also, an opinion is frequently heard which questions the intrinsic and unbreakable bond between faith and morality. Intrinsic and unbreakable bond between faith and morality. Think of that eagle and the broken wings. Our faith has to have strong doctrinal things, faith in Jesus, a good relationship with Jesus, but an intrinsic and unbreakable bond to right deeds, to good morality. And it's broken, my friends, and we got to put those wings back together on the beautiful church we love. I'm Father Tom Coyes. You've been listening to listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred.